I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, there's a certain ick factor to talking about the world of parasites. These are the little creatures that we live with every day, blood-feasting mosquitoes, aggressive ticks, and now we're dealing with the new world screwworm here in Texas. But where do these vermin fit into the web of life, into the vast ecosystem? From the wilds of Africa to the rainforest of the Amazon to the South Texas brush country, they play a vital role. Yet I don't want to get up close and personal with these creatures. They can spread serious and deadly diseases to people and animals. So how should we think about parasites? Are they the villains of the animal kingdom, or are they grossly misunderstood? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We look down on parasites. Calling someone a parasite is a stinging insult. You're accusing them of benefiting from another person or group of society while giving nothing in return. But is it actually true of real parasites? Do they give nothing in return to the ecosystem? The world of parasitic creatures is actually quite complex, and it's all around us, and it is essential. Dino Martins studies parasites. He has written the book Hidden Creatures, Luscious Leeches, Bashful Botflies, and the Wonderful History Shaping the World of Parasites. And Dino, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much. Delighted to join you.
And thanks for joining us from Kenya, all the way from Kenya. Appreciate that. So what are you trying to do with this book? Are you trying to change our minds about how we think about parasites?
Thank you. Yes, I am trying at one level to get people to pay attention to parasites, because wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you're doing, at some point in your life, you will encounter a parasite. So you'd better pay attention to them and learn about them. But I'm also trying to take people along with me on the journey of wonder that I myself have had in looking at nature, including parasites, and ultimately realizing that, you know, we care about things that are beautiful, and that's wonderful, but we also need to care about and understand things that are bizarre. And that's important, because if we don't, we won't have a complete picture of the world around us.
What does something have to be a parasite?
That's a great question. And there are actually many different ways of defining a parasite. We can talk about something that feeds on something else in certain units, a unit less than one. So if we think of a tick feeding on a deer, or if we think of a mosquito biting somebody. But basically, a parasitic relationship is one where, you know, two organisms or more organisms might interact, two species, for example. And in one case, one is deriving a benefit. It's taking something. So it's generally food or nutrients from another one, and the other one is paying a cost. So it's an exploitative relationship. So parasites are basically the original moochers. They're mooching off other animals.
Well, I mean, that seems like a negative, but we wouldn't want to have parasites. But you lay out a case that they are an important part of the web of life.
Correct. And basically, well, look, parasites are devastating. Parasites can be deadly. And we have done battle with parasites through many centuries and will continue to do so. But the case I'm making in the book is that parasites are part of this incredible tapestry, this fabric of life that's all around us. And by some measures, half of all living things, all species, are parasites in one way or another. And so we've got to figure them out. We've got to live with them. And we can't get rid of them entirely, because if we did so, we would have we tear the fabric of life apart, and that wouldn't work.
Well, let me ask you about this new world screw worm that is now back in Texas. It had been eradicated from the United States and Mexico, parts of Central America, but now it is back. Why do we call it a new world screw worm?
Well, like so many things, you call it the new world screw worm because there already was an old world screw worm that was known about before the new world screw worm became more familiar to scientists. So screw worms are just absolutely incredible. I mean, they are horrifying parasites, but they are amazing. And the new world screw worm is also known as a primary screw worm. It's a fly, basically. A fly, it's kind of actually quite a beautiful fly. It's got this shiny blue body and, very, very sort of bright reddish eyes. But it does something really, really disgusting. What it does is it lays its eggs and the larvae feed on living flesh. Because many, many flies lay their eggs in questionable places. But typically their larvae, their maggots feed on decaying or dead flesh. But in this case, these flies, the larvae have evolved to feed on living flesh. And as you pointed out, it is back in Texas. It's not a new arrival. It was there before. And it's come back now. It's everyone's learning about it because it is absolutely horrendous. It's an amazing, amazing organism.
Well, the more that we know about the life cycle of the screw worm, the better we are at trying to prevent its spread or trying to get it back away from Texas, eradicate it again. And one thing is, so the fly will land on a wound or an opening on an animal or person, and they will deposit the eggs. The eggs will hatch. And these maggots will feed on the living flesh, but then then when they have their fill, they drop off and they go into the soil where they go through their metamorphosis. And so that's an important part of identifying that life cycle, because I'm hearing from Texas experts saying if you have an animal with screw worm and it dies, put it on like a concrete slab or put it on a tarp or something. Don't leave it in the ground because it'll just allow this cycle to continue.
That's correct. And the fascinating thing is there's actually a couple of species. So there is the one screwworm species that lays its eggs on animals directly, a scratch, a wound, a tick bite. On young animals, the sort of navel scar tissue is targeted, but occasionally they can actually lay even on kind of unbroken, normal skin, and the larvae will be able to find a way into the host. There's another species that actually comes and lays after the initial maggots have established themselves. So they kind of take advantage of the wound that's created by the screwworm. And I know it is absolutely horrifying. And you know what? It's actually quite widespread. So the old world screwworm, which many of us entomologists here are familiar with, is fairly widespread. You will see animals suffering from this at certain times. It tends to go, quite seasonal with certain kinds of warmer, hotter, kind of humid weather. But in both cases, it's this eating of living flesh and creating these wounds that become infected. And before it was controlled in Texas and other places, it was actually, devastating. It was even responsible for killing off huge numbers of animals. It was affecting the livestock industry very severely, the beef industry, as well as the number of deer. The population of deer were really knocked back when the screwworm was more abundant.
All right, we're going to be talking more about parasites in our world, mosquitoes, ticks, mites, all these things that are all around us all the time. Where do they fit in the animal kingdom? How highly specialized they are is amazing. If you've got questions or comments about parasites, this is your chance. the questions you've always wanted to ask about parasites, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, having a conversation with Dino Martins. He is the author of the book Hidden Creatures, Lushes, Leeches, Bashful Botflies, and the Wondrous History-Making World of Parasites. If you have a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So why do you call all these creatures, you put all these adjectives on them that are so, you know, you want to elevate them? Why do that? Lushes, leeches. What's so luscious about a leech?
Thank you. No, part of it was tongue in cheek. You know, I was sort of playing
around. That's what the parasites do. They attack your tongue and your cheek.
They do. And part of it was also to try and make people wake up and sit up and pay attention and realize that we look at things and, you know, humans, we're such a judgmental species and we have such strong opinions and such high opinions of ourselves. But I thought, look, let's step back and let's look at the world through the eyes of a parasite if we can. And so what I really tried to do with the book is create that sense of wonder but also show that one of the most important things that drives us is our curiosity. And when we go out and look at things in great detail, we end up learning and completely changing the way the world works for us and for others. And actually a great example is the screwworm in Texas. You know, way back in the 1960s, they actually set up a factory in Texas to breed these screwworms, because that was the way in which they controlled it, thanks to the brilliant breakthroughs made in the 1930s by a scientist, Dr. Nippling, and he worked with another scientist, Dr. Bushland. And what Nippling did was remarkable. I mean, this was the original "Don't Mess with Texas," because this was the breakthrough of understanding that the way the flies mated, their behavior was really interesting. So the males are really promiscuous. They are sort of sleeping around, you know, they mate with multiple females. But the females, it turns out, are really conservative and they only mate once in their life, that's it. So Nippling's breakthrough was coming up with this idea of the sterile insect technique, where you would breed a lot of males, you would sterilize them, and you would release them into a population. They would go out and mate with the females, but there would be no offspring produced. There'd be no eggs produced, because when the females have mated effectively, they can lay lots and lots of eggs, you know, hundreds of eggs over a few days. So Nippling's breakthrough was based on this, you know, curiosity and natural history and looking at things and figuring out the details. And as a result, he was able to take that and, you know, save many, many farmers and many animals a lot of misery. And actually what they did is they first went to the island of Curaçao in the Caribbean and there, you know, released thousands of sterile males, did it over a period of time, were able to completely eradicate, control the screwworm, and then they set it up in Texas. And that is, you know, that was an ongoing program, kind of pushing it back south. The production and eradication program then moved into parts of Mexico, and it was very effective. Of course, why is it coming back is a big question, but there's many reasons related to climate and trade and travel and all these other things that are involved.
And is this technique also being used for other species, say like malaria-carrying mosquitoes?
It is. And, you know, that's a really good question with mosquitoes, because mosquitoes are one of the parasites, one of the vectors, organisms that spread disease, that cause so much harm around the world to people. There are, you know, so many different viruses, as well as bacteria, as well as worms, and other pathogens that are transmitted by mosquitoes.
It's a deadly, it's the most deadly animal or creature that there is.
Absolutely. And scientists are working on understanding these other organisms that live inside mosquitoes. For example, there are these reproductive parasites that live in the mosquitoes and can change the sex ratio, often producing more females, or sometimes, you know, killing off males. There's all kinds of bizarre things going on. But it is a technique that's being trialed, is to release mosquitoes that have been tweaked genetically to see if that can be, you know, spread through the population. Now, the important thing to remember is, as we do this and we're interfering with nature doing this for good reason, nature responds and evolution is, you know, always happening. And so both in the case of the screwworm and in the case of the mosquitoes, there will be natural selection. So one of the things with the screwworm control, it worked to a point. And then actually what had happened in sterilizing the flies, you know, in their millions and even billions so they could release them, that affected their genetics. And it meant some of the flies they were releasing were not flying long distances. So they were not actually searching for mates. They were kind of lazy. And that as a result meant the wild males could do their business and were being more successful. And so they had to tweak that and understand it. So we are basically in this arms race with insects. And sometimes we win, sometimes we just kind of, you know, doggy paddle to stay in the same place. And sometimes we lose. And it's a battle that we will keep fighting for as long as there are people on the planet, there will be parasites.
Yeah, but we're humanity, concerns about public health, also about, you know, agriculture. It seems like we're in a constant conflict with these parasites.
We are. One of the points I try to make in the book is that we are the cause of those conflicts. We are creating the conditions that many parasites are benefiting from because they are responding to these opportunities. So, for example, the way we raise animals, concentrating them in larger and larger numbers, trading in certain animals and moving them across, you know, huge distances, using or misusing certain chemicals that end up helping in, you know, insects indirectly because they evolve resistance to these solutions that we have. And so it is sometimes, you know, something we need to do, but I think we should all approach it with a bit more understanding and really the details, which is what a lot of scientists are working on in global health and public health, as well as in veterinary health, is, you know, trying to stay ahead of that curve of the tricks that we come up with and then the tricks that the parasites come up with to outwit us.
Right. And so on the screwworm issue, there's a debate about whether or not they should provide out into the woods ivermectin feed for wildlife to protect them against screwworm. But the counter argument is, which I've heard from officials, is that we don't know the proper dosage and we could actually be creating a new breed of screwworm, which would be immune from ivermectin, which is a supplement that they can give cattle to fight off the screwworm. Is that
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. And ivermectin is this amazing discovery. You know, I write about it in the book. It was a Japanese scientist who found these bacteria on a golf course and sent it to his colleague, Campbell, who was working at Merck in the United States. And Campbell went on to develop this very, very effective antiparasitic drug from this bacteria, just like penicillin was developed from a bacterium much earlier. And so we have all these different solutions that we come up with, but in using them, you actually can actually create a problem. And so will the screwworms, if exposed to low doses of ivermectin, develop resistance? And the answer is almost inevitably, because that is how natural selection works. If we are, you know, selecting for that, as it were, applying the pressure of this force of the ivermectin. But in the short term, it can be a very effective way of at least managing an outbreak. So one has to sort of balance these things and you know, decide what's useful at what point in time.
Another product, Dectomax, which is used by cattle raisers in Texas. And just reading the label, it has this long list of everything that it can help your cows, you know, fight against, eyeworm and one thing after the other. So I had no idea there were so many parasites that they needed to protect these animals from. And so,
yes,
yeah, so there's a lot out there.
There is a lot out there. And I think that was, for me, even in writing the book as a naturalist, knowing about these parasites, I was just constantly amazed as I would learn about just yet another incredible life history cycle of how some of these parasites can actually move between different species, between different hosts as they complete their life cycle. They've evolved these amazing, amazing ways of surviving in different bodies, surviving in the environment, surviving this movement, surviving the changes in climate. So, and they've been around for a very long time. You know, there's evidence of ticks going back into the dark period of dinosaurs. They, you know, they're all these other fossils that I discuss in the book that give us hints at how long parasites have been around and what they've been doing for all that time.
Right there in the fossil record, we can see that parasites were eating the bones of a Tyrannosaurus rex. The largest, most deadliest, you know, a dinosaur out there was being preyed upon by the tiniest of creatures.
That's correct. And even before that, the ancestors of the Tyrannosaurus rex and all the other creatures we were fascinated by would have had parasites living with them.
But we have evolved alongside them. Is that right? And is that why they're so highly specialized?
That's correct. And in some ways, if we think about our attitude towards microbes, you know, bacteria and other microorganisms has really changed with the understanding of the microbiome. In some ways, maybe we can think of some parasites that have lived in very intimate association with both people and with other species as part of that microbiome. They are organisms, you know, we have these mites that live on our eyelashes, we have all kinds of other parasites that live on or around us and have, you know, for as long as we've been human. So the question that, you know, many scientists are starting to ask is, if we get rid of them completely, that's great because, you know, they do cause harm in some cases, but that all may also come at a price. And the price seems to be that our immune system, various sort of inflammatory and autoimmune conditions are actually in some cases solved by, you know, having a parasite, and it sort of, it's complicated biology that's still being figured out, but clearly these are creatures that have lived and co-evolved with people and with all other species for a long time.
But my microbiome provides many benefits to me. It helps me in my digestion, protects my stomach lining, provides important hormones. It is actually, I don't know if I am my microbiome. So
or your microbiome is you.
Yeah. So
is it
if I'm just a vehicle for it. Well, we're going to continue our talk about hidden creatures, luscious leeches, bashful botflies, and the wondrous history-shaping world of parasites with Dino Martins. We're going to take a break. You can call in if you got a question or a comment about parasites, lice, mites, all sorts of worms and things that are in us, in our brains, who knows? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues after this break.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Dino Martin's book, Hidden Creatures, Luscious Leeches, Bashful Botflies, and the Wondrous History-Shaping World of Parasites, combines evolutionary biology, history, field reporting, and Martin's experiences growing up in Kenya. It explores organisms like tapeworms, flies, leeches, ticks, lice, all sorts of things. Parasitic wasp argues that parasites are not just biological villains, but they are an essential participant in the ecosystem and in evolution. So, Dino, you write in a book, you write in the start of it about, as a child in Kenya, you found a caterpillar and you started looking at it and you found that it had dozens of parasitic wasps inside it. And then you discovered even smaller wasps, parasiting the other wasps. So parasites upon parasites. So take us back to that moment. What were you doing? What were you witnessing? How did that inspire you?
You know, that was one of the most kind of breakthrough moments in my life as a child, is just realizing that you've got to look beneath the surface, and what might actually be going on is not immediately obvious to you. And just by raising these caterpillars, which I cared a lot about, you know, I was feeding them and they're beautiful, and I would, you know, sort of stroke them, and then of course watching them transform, undergo this incredible transformation to pupae and then to these gigantic moths that would fly around. But this one caterpillar didn't transform, and then these, you know, I could see these like things squirming in its flesh, and then they burst through its skin. I was absolutely horrified. My friends in school were terrified because everyone was like, the same thing's going to happen to us if we don't destroy this creature.
Yeah, it's like from the movie Aliens, you know?
It was very much like that. But then watching them, you know, they spin these cocoons and they hatch into these wasps, and then learning that the wasps were feeding on the caterpillar, and then realizing actually there were wasps feeding on the wasps feeding on the caterpillar was just like so mind-blowing. And you know what? Now, over 40 years later, I'm actually working on a system of an insect called a cecid that lives in grasses here in Kenya. And it's in partnership with the University of Texas, because the same grass species that's in Kenya has been introduced to Texas, where it's become invasive in some places. And we're realizing the insect that forms these little galls, these little sort of swellings on the plant here, also has parasites and other things that feed on it, and so we're trying to understand, you know, this biology of these plants and these insects and how they've evolved, and the insects that feed on the insects that feed on the plants, and what does that mean for the ecology in Kenya, and also what will that mean, you know, potentially for the ecology in Texas where this species has been introduced. So there are many practical lessons to be learned from this, but we do always have to approach it from just that wonder and curiosity, because there's so much to learn from nature if we just open our eyes.
Let's go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're going to go to Donnie and Jennifer. Hang on. We'll go to you next. But Donnie, go ahead. Donnie, you're on the air.
Okay. Yes, I grew up on a sheep ranch in the heart of Texas. We always had a concern we had to deal with. We called them fleece worms. And, of course, I guess there's that other screw worm. You know, the mamas, you'd share their hind end in January, February. So, in you know, their spring lamb, you want that area clean. You don't want the wet manure, the wet urine, or the afterbirth. Because then, you know, if you had wet wool, you got what we call fleece worms. And anyway, if a sheep, she just lived in misery, she might live over it, she might not. And eventually, you know, that clump of wool may fall off along with that first layer of skin. But anyway, the old timers, you know, that's why they called them fleece worms. So and I asked about screw worms because I heard all those stories. And so there's a different thing. You had the screw worm and whatever this other one is, that's kind of my question here, that we called fleece worms. But about a month ago, my son called. He was over there at home place, and there's a sheep had a predator wound. And he took pictures of the fly, because this was just like a month ago, and we compared the pictures, and my goodness, it was the fleece worm, whatever that one is. But, man, they look nearly identical to the New World screw worm. But anyway, that was just a comment. And I guess the question is the other kind of screw worm or whatever I'm talking about that's been around here, that's always been around, I just want to know the name of it, and I'd appreciate it.
All right, Donnie, appreciate it. Fleece worm, are you familiar with fleece worm, Dino?
I am, because I too kept sheep when I was in school in a rural agricultural community, and we were actually given sheep. Kind of like the 4K, which you have in the US, we had a similar thing called the young farmers. And I was horrified when one of my sheep ended up with these maggots, you know, on it. And they are flies. They're not the same species as the screw worm. We call it fly strike is the term that we use here. And there's multiple different species. The maggots all look fairly similar, so it's hard to tell them apart. And the adult flies, you've got to also, you know, examine them a bit more closely under a microscope and sort of consult an expert. But yes, there are several different species. But if I heard correctly, the question about the screw worm, it's a part of a group of flies called the Calliphoridae, which are the sort of blue bottle flies. And the scientific name is Cochleomyia hominivorax. And the species name hominivorax is a great name because it's, you know, it's sort of the eater of man in a way, which is not entirely true. And then the secondary screwworm, the one that goes and lays its eggs after the primary screwworm has established itself, is the same genus, Cochleomyia, but it's a different species, Macellaria. So there's, you know, there's multiple species, and, you know, scientists always classification goes back and forth. But in this case, you know, I believe that's still the case. That's what we think about the species involved in the new worm, screwworm. In the old world screwworm, it's a different one. The one we're more familiar with here is called Chrysomyia beziana. It's named after an Italian entomologist, so he had the honor of the old world screwworm, Mario Bezzi, having it named after him.
Well, let's go to Jennifer on the phones. And Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm interested in the disease that President Jimmy Carter was trying to eradicate in Africa. I think it was something to do with rivers and blindness. Can you tell me more?
Jennifer, thank you for your call. Dino Martins.
Thank you, Jennifer. That's a great question because it allows us to both celebrate someone and many scientists who worked with him and his foundation, and they were able to successfully eradicate the guinea worm, which is still this absolutely horrifying parasite that spread through water. So the eggs end up in the water where they enter these little creatures called copepods. They're tiny little crustaceans that swim around. And then typically in, you know, in nature, they would be cycled into, they'd be consumed by something. But in humans, what the guinea worm does is it actually enters the body and then it sort of travels through the body and it ends up, the mature female worm grows really long, like, you know, a couple of feet long and lies along a limb and then kind of bursts out through a sore and slowly kind of unfolds as she releases these eggs. Now, of course, it's absolutely horrifying. And there's some people who even think that the symbol of medicine, the staff with the two serpents coiling around it, are actually an ancient depiction of some of people coiling the guinea worm around a stick, because that's what people used to traditionally do when the worm would start emerging. Now, you would think, why would a worm do this? This is really disgusting and horrifying. So the worm, of course, has evolved this as a strategy because the eggs need to drop into fresh water. And so if they draw out this process, they increase the chances of their eggs landing in the right place and then, you know, continuing the cycle. And it was actually another scientist way back, a Russian, who figured out the life cycle. And once that was figured out, then, you know, further work was done and research was done that led to the eradication. And, you know, and President Carter was just, you know, such a champion in recognizing this, that this was a problem that could be solved. But we have to stay on top of it. You know, the same species of guinea worm has now been seen in dogs. It might go into baboons and some other primates. So like all these things, you know, nature is still out there. She's wonderful and she's terrible, and we need to keep on our toes. Thanks.
Yeah, and all the conflicts that are happening in Africa, it's making it more difficult to put in those interventions and allowing some of these creatures to, again, find their space. We're going to take another break. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Hidden Creatures, more of that with Dino Martins. Stay tuned.
A year ago, one of the deadliest floods in U.S. history tore through the Texas Hill Country. Since then, we've been following up with survivors.
Everything is gone.
And people who lost loved ones.
I find myself just shaking my head, saying, I can't believe I find myself here.
You can hear their stories on the podcast After the Flood from the Texas Newsroom and PBS's Frontline, out now.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Dino Martins is with us, joining us all the way from Kenya. His book is Hidden Creatures, Luscious Leeches, Bashful Botflies, and the Wondrous History-Shaping World of Parasites. What history have they shaped?
Parasites have shaped almost all of they find them in these ancient carcasses, in Egyptian mummies. If we think about the plague, you know, there were multiple plagues through history that completely changed the fate of hundreds of millions of people. Today, I was bitten by a mosquito, and when I was sitting out in the garden, and over 1 billion people on the planet today were bitten by mosquitoes, if not more than that. And so parasites, you know, have shaped us. We've shaped them. They've brought down empires. They've scared even the popes who fled from their palaces during certain outbreaks of diseases. The pharaohs, you know, the kings, the beggars, everybody, the farmers, the animals who we love and care for, everyone's affected by them.
So did they evolve specifically to feed on sleeping humans? What do we know about their evolutionary history?
Bed bugs are so cool. I mean, they are amazing, you know, so resilient, benefiting from what we're doing, creating sort of perfect living spaces for them. But no, bed bugs did not set out to get us. They took advantage of us kind of coming across them. Bed bugs are a part of a group. There are quite a few species on bats. And it appears that at some point, you know, as we were sharing maybe ancient caves, living alongside bats, that somehow the bed bugs made their way onto us. And then, you know, we sort of carried them around the world. And then we've given them to at least another species. It looks like chickens, who also have bed bugs sometimes affecting them, may have actually acquired it from people. So we can also be a source of parasites for other animals, which is a big change from, you know, the history of humanity, because they're just, you know, we are the dominant force on the planet today.
But we can look at like the genetic history, evolutionary history of things like certain mites. We have head lice and body lice, and for the genitalia area. And looking at that, we're able to learn a lot about how humans conquered the planet. So, that's fascinating.
It is amazing. And it takes, you know, it's scientists in the past, it was very painstaking work of dissecting the, finding the parasites and studying them and dissecting them. Today, we've got these amazing tools. You know, we can sequence their entire genomes and even their microbiomes and even the pathogens, the bacteria and other things that they are carrying. And we can work out all kinds of things. You know, we can pick up a tick or a leech, and you can figure out which animals it's been feeding on, and you can even figure out which diseases it's been spreading in the past. And as we do this, you know, we realize actually there's just still so much to discover. There are, you know, if half of all species are parasites, we're still just, you know, barely scratching the surface in terms of our understanding of them. And at the same time, you know, causing huge impacts on the planet and disrupting them, and actually in a way making ourselves more vulnerable, because if we take away other hosts, you know, maybe they will actually be forced to switch, and that puts pressure on parasites to find new hosts, and guess who's just shown up in large numbers? That's us. So understanding the evolution of parasites is a really fascinating area of research. And as I was writing the book, I had, you know, it was amazing to read all these different papers, and especially reading the historical accounts, learning about the people that made these discoveries and what really motivated them, and how incredibly passionate they were, how much some of them suffered, you know, some even lost their lives, but made these breakthroughs that in a way allow us to live the life we have today, which is, you know, much healthier and more comfortable, but we mustn't take it for granted. We have to continue to be curious and continue to invest in science, because these problems will continue to arise and we will still need to solve them.
Is climate change impacting how things are changing with parasites? Anyway, I'm going to get this caller on. Just called in. I'm going to get him on before we run out of time. Malcolm, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, afternoon. I just had a question about what Cyclospora is, where it came from, and why it's like become such a big deal as of recent.
All right.
Especially Malcolm, in like Texas and everything.
Yeah, so we're reading these headlines about these cases of diarrhea, this happening across Texas. And so Cyclospora, you know, that is that a parasite? Do you know?
Yes, Cyclospora is a parasite. It's a coccidian, which is related. They're part of the protozoan. So it's the malaria parasite is a protozoan. There's another one called Toxoplasma, which circulates through cats and people and rodents and stuff, and has caused all kinds of problems. And look, they're really abundant. They're very common, this particular group of coccidians. They This one causes, diarrheal problems in humans and produces a disease. I think it's cyclosporiasis is the disease. I'm not an expert on the disease, but what I do know about the coccidians, because they are an amazing, amazing group, a very large group of what we call obligate intracellular parasites. That means that they can only complete their life cycle in a parasitic way, and they have to invade a cell, and that's what they're doing. They infect all mammals, every single mammal. There's thousands of species of mammals. Every single one is infected. And there's also a few in birds and fish and reptiles and amphibians, but mammals are their main hosts, and they're very species specific. So different mammals have different coccid species that that live with them. I can't comment on where this one came from. I think scientists are still trying to figure it out, but they're naturally out there. You know, obviously they spread through contaminated food and water. So, you know, that there have been multiple outbreaks through time, through history. And this one, you know, coming back to the question about climate, is definitely they benefit from certain conditions. So, you know, generally kind of hotter, wetter conditions allow more of these kinds of parasites to thrive.
Well, it does seem like the hotter climate allows a longer tick season. We're seeing that here in Texas. And it also would allow a greater spread for the screwworm, a warmer climate. So like freezing temperature, does that seem to be a good protection against most parasites, or is that just the lucky few?
It depends on the parasite, but yes, definitely many of the tropical and subtropical species cannot survive freezing temperatures or cold temperatures for a long period, and that will kind of knock them back. But the fact is, everything can evolve and adapt, and you know, things are starting to spread and change even their behavior. We have the situation here of mosquitoes that spread certain diseases tended to feed at night. And so if you were sleeping under a net, which is one of the tools we've used, as these treated bed nets, very effective, you sleep under them, that's 99% of the problem solved. But guess what? There's some mosquitoes now that are starting to bite at other times of day. And since, you know, you can't spend your whole life hiding under a net, that makes you more vulnerable. So we've got to keep kind of looking and figuring these things out. But yes, definitely temperature, and especially, you know, insects and other arthropods, they're very, very sensitive and very responsive to temperature. So for example, with the screwworm in Texas and other places, in hot weather, in warm weather, it'll complete its life cycle in 24 days. In really cool weather, it'll go for a few months, which is actually sometimes more difficult for the animal because you've got this festering and these infections. But if actually the temperatures go even higher, it actually does affect the screwworm as well, and the females maybe lay fewer eggs. But in sort of the normal, you know, warm to hot conditions, 24 days life cycle, which is really a very short period of time, and you know, a female lays 400 eggs at a time and can lay almost 3,000 eggs in their lifetime. Well, you know, you start doing the maths and you're like, wow, this is really something we need to figure out.
So you want people to recognize that screwworms are part of something that keeps nature in balance. You know, that's a big focus. How do we keep nature in balance? But without them, without parasites, we would definitely have an issue.
Absolutely. We may not like living with them, but we're never going to be living without them. And they're here for the rest of our time on this planet.
Dino Martins, he is an evolutionary biologist, a naturalist. He is an author. The book is richly written, telling his firsthand accounts, getting malaria, having these pepper mites on the airplane, all sorts of weird things happening to him with these parasites. Dino Martins, author of Hidden Creatures, Luscious Leeches, Bashful Botflies, and the Wondrous History-Shaping World of Parasites. Fun talking to you today.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you all the way from Kenya to Texas.
Yeah. crazy. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.